Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
yes, indeed, we started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing about biting the apple with Pete Seeger and David Burns and the Rivertown Kids. That is a Grammy Award-winning song, as a matter of fact, part of a Grammy Award-winning album. We have a terrific show here on the Green Power and Wellness Hour. Going to start with Elliot Nagin of the Union of Concerned Scientists, then talk about wind power a bit because we didn't finish up from last week's show. I don't like to leave things dangling from a previous show. And then Mary Olson of the Nuclear Information Resource Service will join us from the Southeast talking about all new reactors in general, but especially the Vogtle and Levy County disasters in the Southeast. And we are also joined by the great Bob Alvarez, one of the stalwarts of the Safe Energy Movement for, I won't reveal how long, but my co-author, esteemed co-author on the book Killing Our Own, source of tremendous information on radiation and health. We're going to talk to Bob about radioactive tuna. Those of you out having lunch with sushi, you may want to reconsider after you hear what we talked about with Bob. Radioactive tuna has been found off the coast of San Diego. Not a great development. But let's start with Elliot Nagin. Elliot from the Union of Concerned Scientists last week. Elliot, yeah, you're at a retreat, so we're going to let you go first, and then you can go back and retreat some more. We were talking last week with Bob Goff of the Native American community and Christina Raleigh and Ron Zweig in Falmouth, Massachusetts, about wind power. And we were talking with you at the end of the show about the production tax credits, which are tell us what's going on with them in Congress, if you would, for the wind industry.
Okay, well, the production tax credit is basically an essential federal tax break that Congress has been giving to the wind industry and also a few other renewable industries as well. But it's been really critical for the wind industry because it basically gives it a more of a level playing field to compete with coal and with natural gas. What it does specifically is it provides a credit of 2.2 cents per kilowatt hour of electricity produced by wind turbines for at least the first 10 years of production.
And this is a federal tax credit,
yes.
Which is helps the income tax of rich people who invest.
Well, what this does is it really helps for investment purposes. It helps get new projects off the ground. And like I said, the big problem here is that Congress is very loath to give this credit for any length of time, so they keep renewing it after every few years, and then they have to come back to the table and renew it again or extend it. Unlike a lot of the goodies, the tax breaks that are permanent for the oil industry, the coal industry, and the nuclear industry, they make the wind industry come cup in hand every few years to Congress and say, please give us a break. Meanwhile, these breaks for these other more mature industries have been continuing, in some cases, for more than 100 years.
Yes, and so we don't have a level playing field with the wind power. Now, what is happening right now? Where do we stand? I've been reading, I posted at nukefree.org, estimates of as much as 30 or 40,000. Well, actually, it was your article in Huffington Post last week. Well, you estimated something like 30 or 40,000 jobs that might be lost.
Yeah, there was a study that came out late last year that said that if this tax break isn't extended by the end of this year, when it ends, that the industry will have to lay off as many as 37,000 workers, which is about half its workforce, and it would have to cut back dramatically on new projects, obviously without those workers. Keep in mind that over the last decade, wind power has been one of the most fastest growing energy sources not only in the United States but around the world. And this would put a real a damper on continued expansion.
And meanwhile, the subsidies for coal and what I call King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, especially fracking now of natural gas, they continue unabated.
Oh, yeah. What's really interesting about this is that there are two bills that are languishing in Congress right now. They're both sponsored by Republicans. And both the National Association of Manufacturers and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and my organization, the Union of Concerned Scientists, Strange Bedfellows, we're all saying that you should renew this tax credit. So it has bipartisan support, but what it's being used as a political football right now. What's happened is that House leadership insists that the fact that they look at it as a cost to the Treasury, because to give the wind industry continued tax break, it would cost the Treasury $3 billion to $4 billion in tax revenues. President Obama and others in Congress have said, well, let's take a look at the ongoing tax breaks to the oil and gas industry, which has basically, on average, pulled in nearly $5 billion in subsidies per year from 1918 to today. They've been, for almost 100 years, the oil and gas industry has received $4.86 billion in today's dollars in tax breaks. Meanwhile, this fledgling industry, the wind industry, has only been really getting tax breaks since the early 90s, middle 90s. And they have to, like I said, have to beg every few years to get this tax break renewed. If they ended the tax break for the oil and gas industry, it would more than pay for continuing the tax break for the wind industry. And I guess it's my point that why are we continuing to give tax breaks to companies that are making tremendous amounts of money? I mean, three of the top Fortune 500 companies are oil and oil companies. It's a mature industry. They don't need handouts from the United States anymore from the government.
Right.
But this fledgling industry that really has a lot of promise and could eventually probably, along with other renewables, supplant coal in the next 20 years. Why are we not helping them out?
Okay, so Elliot Nagin, real quickly, because I know you got to go, what is the prospect for getting the wind energy production tax credit renewed?
And well,
what
can people do? One knows. I don't have a crystal ball. Like I said, it's become a political football. It has bipartisan support on the Hill. And
bipartisan opposition.
Well, the problem is it's being held up because of the concern over the federal deficit. It's being used as a football. But meanwhile, no one's questioning the continued goodies that have been going to the oil, coal, and nuclear industries,
right,
which are all mature industries, but they're still on the dole.
Where can people sign a petition, write in, support the wind production tax credit? Give us a link if you could.
Obviously they could contact their representatives and senators in Congress and put some pressure on them.
And I would assume the American Wind Energy Association.
Definitely American Wind Energy Association.
Okay, that's AWEA.org, is that right?
That's right.
AWEA.org to support the wind production tax credit. Elliot, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
I know you got to run. Elliot Nagin of the Union of Concerned Scientists updating us on, and we'll have you back, Elliot, to give us a perennial update on what's happening with the wind production tax credit.
Thanks,
you so
Harvey.
Much. Okay. Now we turn to Mary Olson and Bob Alvarez, two of the stalwarts of the movement for a nuclear-free future. Mary is with the Union of Concerned, I'm sorry, with the Nuclear Information Resource Service Organization, and Bob. Bob, you're with Union of Concerned Scientists. I'm sorry, I keep going to UCS for some reason. I'm with the IPS now, is that right?
That's right.
The Institute for Policy Studies. What is your title there?
I'm a senior scholar.
Senior scholar? You're too young to be a senior scholar.
Yeah, I know.
And Mary, yeah, you're a junior scholar. So, Mary, let me start with Mary real quick, because I know she's got to go as well. Bob, you and I will be in it for the long haul, as usual. Mary, you're in what town are you in? Asheville, South, North Carolina?
Yes, I'm based in Asheville, North Carolina, but I'm the only field staffer. The rest of the organization is inside the Beltway.
Okay. And what you're focusing on which nukes down there?
Well, you know, we looked at it about 5 years ago and saw most of the new reactor proposals coming to this region. It's not, strictly speaking, all in the southeast, but we have about two-thirds of the new proposals here in the southeastern states.
That would be North and South Carolina, Georgia, and Florida, basically.
Yeah, and one in Virginia, and there's some zombie reactors happening up in Tennessee. Those are ones that were previously canceled, allowed to sit for many years, decades, in fact, and now they're trying to go back and complete Watts Bar 2 and possibly Bellefonte 1
so,
and 2.
A zombie reactor is a reactor that was stopped, gratefully, before it was finished, but now they go back to these rotting hulks and try to revive them. Is that
exactly.
correct?
Exactly. So that's like... Two, and you get something about like a zombie because everything's already aged. It's all pre-aged materials before they even put it online.
So you, if you have, like, a, as I'm sure you do, Mary, a 1954 Ford Fairlane in your front yard up on blocks, that's the equivalent of going out there and trying to restart it. Is that
yeah,
correct?
Without any, you know, real restoration effort, rather, you know, naive to think all those wires are still going to work, right?
Right, right. And, Bob, you've worked on these issues as well on a national basis, these zombie reactors and also the reactors they're trying to build in the southeast.
Right, and now the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the Department of Energy are in the process of trying to figure out if they can keep our current reactors running for 80 years.
80 years. So everybody out there, raise your hand if you're driving an 80-year-old car. Does anybody know, do you, anybody know anybody driving an 80-year-old car? What would that be? That would be 19... my math is no good. 34. Who's driving a 1932 automobile? Anybody? I mean, I haven't seen one lately.
Well, not only that, they expect you to be going twice as fast as the automobile was designed to go.
Right, and no seatbelts.
I mean, that's sort of where, you know, what's going on in terms of. I guess you would want to call it politely strategic planning.
Well, that's let's say it's generous to call it strategic planning. Now, Mary, you're focused on the AP1000.
Yeah, and also
design.
Just the fact that I want to hook to what Elliot was talking about, because nuclear has been around. The first reactors came online in the early 60s.
1957,
I think there were experimental
actually.
Ones in the 50s.
Well, yeah,
you know, it's not
shipping
new.
Port. Yeah.
But on the other hand, unlike his case for oil being able to survive just fine without federal help, this industry is not going to be able to build a new nuclear power plant in this country without massive federal support. And it's being done in the form of what's called a loan guarantee, but actually it's a federal loan in the case of Vogtle and the other reactors that are being considered for this money. It would actually be Treasury notes loaned to the corporation. And this is because Wall Street learned its lesson. You had an enormous asset sitting there in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and overnight it turned into one of the largest liabilities in industrial history at Three Mile Island.
From a $900 million asset on the books to a $2 billion liability. And, of course, they're all insured by you and me, the taxpayers. They can't get significant private insurance. Bob, do you know what is the exact number on the, or maybe Mary, you know as well, on the federal fund to underwrite an accident at a major nuclear plant? I thought it was around $12.8 billion.
It's around $12.8 billion, but you have to just keep in mind that this is money that they have socked away. They're supposed to come up with this if some major accident happens anywhere. And several years ago, about 7 or 8 years ago, we commissioned a study to look at this issue and discovered that a big portion of the reactor fleet now is owned by multi-tiered holding companies that have layers and layers of limited liability corporations, and these are companies that are operating in what you call deregulated environments. They no longer have a captive rate base. So what we discovered is that these companies that own this large fleet of reactors, Exelon being the one that owns the most, are set up in a manner where, you know, this is deliberately meant to shield the parent corporation from any liability. So what we discovered and we reported is that the law and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the whole regulatory regime of the country, never envisioned this kind of corporate structure, and that if there were a major accident where they'd have to pony up this money, all they have to do is file for bankruptcy, and the taxpayer is left on the hook.
Now, Mary Olson in North Carolina, is that true of the reactors being built in the southeast there?
It is, and I think we have to take notes from what's happened in Japan, where a golf course owner tried to go to Tokyo Electric that owns the Fukushima disaster and said, you know, I've got a contaminated golf course, and TEPCO came back and said, well, that's not our radioactivity anymore. It belongs to you. And I think that that kind of thinking has been going on in this country during this limited liability period. It's no news to the rest of the business world. And I think it's part of why Wall Street absolutely won't touch new reactors. They know that this is the case.
Well, of course, if Monsanto was involved, that golf course owner, they'd sue him for stealing their radioactive material.
Indeed.
What is happening now? Mary, you're in the southeast, and that's really, as you point out, the focal point. We've got two reactors somewhat under construction in South Carolina at the Summer site, two reactors somewhat under construction at the Vogtle site. We've got Levy County in Florida, where they're talking about building two reactors. The price tag's already gone up to $24 billion there. And then a fixed job at Crystal River in Florida that's gone over $1 billion in a total disaster there. But let's do Vogtle first, because that's the one that everybody's focused on with the loan guarantees. What is the status of the Vogtle plant, please?
Well, it was the first license for a new reactor granted in the United States in 39 years. I don't think they could quite stomach 40, so they had to beat that.
Uh-huh.
But it's not like them getting that license has made that much difference in terms of activity. That site had a pre-construction authorization for the non-nuclear portions, and that actually started a couple of years ago. The loan guarantee, though, has been held up, and unless and until they have the assurance of that federal money, I don't think you're going to see the actual reactor components coming into that site.
Well, my understanding is that Vogtle, Bob, you can chime in on this, is that they started off by pouring substandard concrete and then moved ahead with rebar steel that didn't meet specification. Are there any other little trivial problems that they've introduced?
Well, gee, I haven't followed it at that level of detail, but I do understand that they're now somewhere in excess of $900 million above their original estimated cost.
And this is the loan guarantees have not been finalized, is that correct?
That's my understanding. And that, you know, what's at issue here is that there is an upfront expense for getting these loan guarantees. It's called a subsidy expense, and it's about 1% of the total cost of the project or the total loan. And so, you know, 1% of $800 billion is quite a bit of money. And so I think there's a lot of haggling about how they can come up with that money and whether they can do in-kind contributions in terms of the land that they occupy and other things, and whether that will pass the LAAF test. But they still have to come up with some, a significant amount of cash up front to pay for the subsidy expense that's required under federal law.
But we don't know how much. I'm sorry, Mary, go ahead.
I just wanted to throw in that we really should never lose sight of the fact that Vogtle was the largest single cost overrun that I'm aware of in the first generation of reactors. They promised originally four reactor units for $500 million. Two were delivered for $9 billion. That was a 3,000% cost overrun on the two units that are sitting there today and have been operating for decades. Now they're trying to add two more. So the fact that they're only, less than $1 billion over their cost is wait and see what happens over the course of this thing.
Bob, you worked for the Department of Energy and for Senator John Glenn in Congress. And have of all the people I know, you've got probably the best detail grasp on this loan guarantee program. What is the implication of the President of the United States agreeing to give the loan guarantees of $8.33 billion to a project and then failing to finalize the deal and then having the project jump in price by at least $900 million? What's the legality of all that?
Well, I mean, that's all to be determined in terms of the legality of it. I mean, the sort of one of the key provisions of law that the federal government has to adhere to is the Federal Credit Reform Act of whatever year it was passed, sometime in the 1990s, and that law requires that if the government is going to be providing a loan guarantee, especially of this size, where, as Mary correctly points out, 100% of that loan comes directly out of the U.S. Treasury. It's not provided by any private bank or anything. The entity that gets the loan has to come up with a fee to cover what they call the subsidy expense, and that has to do with what the risk might be of default. Other things have to be factored in, and the general formula that has been adopted is that it's approximately 1% of the total amount of money that's to be guaranteed here. So it's in the hundreds of millions of dollars, and so this is what caused the effort to build two new reactors near Calvert Cliffs in Maryland to collapse, is that they couldn't come up with that cash, and the rules were rules. So we'll see how this all plays out. I mean, I think that it's going to be very hard, given the sort of political climate over trying to control spending and subsidies and all these other things, for something like this to allow to slip through without, following the rules.
Mary, what's the climate down there for continuing with Vogtle? I know the ratepayers in Georgia are being forced to pay for this thing as it's being built. Is that correct?
Yes. It's the old name for it is construction work in progress, but in Florida, it's called nuclear cost recovery, which is a little bit more transparent. And the people there even are feeling that this is a delegated taxation on them, and they're calling it the nuclear tax to build the two reactors that are being proposed for the Progress Energy Service area on the Gulf Coast in Florida. So, different areas have different ways of talking about these things, but yes, construction work in progress is happening in Georgia. Ratepayers can see on their bill there actually a fee that is for the nuclear power plant. I just want to mention that our website has an action step for those who want to contact the Department of Energy or the president about this loan guarantee business. And our website is www.nirs.org, and that's right on the front page, Nuclear Good. Information and Resource Service.
And, Bob, where can we find your website?
I'm at ips.dc.org.
Okay. Robert Alvarez or Bob?
Bob at ips.dc.org.
Okay. And, Bob, you mentioned a bill, a federal law, that imposes certain requirements on a loan guarantee. Can you give us the name of that again?
It's called the Federal Credit Reform Act.
When was that passed?
When
was that passed?
Oh, I'm just looking it up right now.
Oh, okay.
Tell you the truth.
All right.
It was passed in 1990.
Okay.
And it was basically meant to reform how the government extends credit. And one of the key elements of it is the government has to receive some sort of fee, a subsidy fee, in advance to providing such a huge loan guarantee, especially one that's going to cover, at least 80% of the total project cost.
Now,
it's pretty substantial, Vogel has to come up with, let's see,
Well, what are they estimating is the cost of the plant now? Mary, do you have a firm estimate?
I mean, Vogtle's going to have to come up with, it depends. The loan guarantee is for $8.3 billion.
Right.
And so
but the cost of the reactors has already jumped.
Southern Company has been very unwilling to publish any figures about the total costs. There has been a number of $14 billion out there, but then
for
you have to scratch
one? For one reactor or two?
For two. Uh-huh. But you have to scratch your head. Now, the Levy County estimate has been open and on the table at first 20, then 22, now $24 billion for two units. But that's the only greenfield site in the proposed fleet. And I have to say that every place is a bad place to build a reactor, but where Progress Energy is targeting these two proposed AP1000s would be in an area of some of the most pristine freshwater springs I've seen anywhere on this planet, where the water just flows out of the ground turquoise colored, and there's quite an incredible, you know, biome. Communities of species that depend on this incredibly fresh, clear water, and that's
Levy
what
County,
they want
Florida.
To suck up with their cooling pipes.
Now, I've posted an article at nukefree.org about this by Ivan Penn from the Tampa Bay Times about how the Levy County project doesn't seem to want to die. When you say greenfields, of course, people should understand that means it's a site that does not have another nuclear plant on it.
It has nothing, no industrial development at all. So
well,
it would cost more for Progress to build there than it will cost at Vogtle, because there's a lot of infrastructure already in place at the Vogtle site. So it should be somewhat less, but we doubt it's half.
Yeah, and Ivan Penn's thesis in this piece, and we're going to break here in a minute, but Ivan Penn's, Mary, if you can stick with us, that's fine. If you need to go, let me know. Ivan Penn's point is that Progress Energy has spent so much money now, over $1 billion, 1.1, on the Levy County nukes, that they can't bring themselves to pull the plug, even though everybody is telling them this is going to be a ridiculously disastrous economic fiasco here. We're talking with Bob Alvarez from the Institute for Policy Studies and Mary Olson from the Nuclear Information and Resource Service about nuclear power and the various problems that we got with it. We will return after a short break with Dana Lyons singing the Soarotopia Rocky Top songs. The future for all of us, green-powered energy. We're back with Mary Olson from the Nuclear Information Resource Service and Bob Alvarez from the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, both talking about Mary's in the Southeast, Asheville, North Carolina, talking about nuclear power. And Mary, you got to run. I wanted to ask you from the view from the Southeast here. Vogtle is the only reactor, along with VC Summer in South Carolina, even vaguely under construction in the United States. What are the chances of stopping it, and how are we going to do it?
Well, it's clear. There is one place to easily, relatively easily, stop a reactor, and that is the money flow. And right now, Vogtle does not have its federal loan guarantee, and all estimates are that without it, it will not happen. And I just want to take a moment to brag on the fact that those loan guarantees were actually authorized by President Bush and Vice President Cheney in their energy bill in 2004, and we have yet to see a nuclear loan guarantee actually pass from the Department of Energy to a nuclear corporation. So we have a theory, you know, at that level, the law says this is possible, but in terms of actual reality and activity, it has not occurred, and we believe that with sufficient action and engagement by people who care about our energy future, weighing in, that we can stop this. And if we do, it will make all the difference in terms of any future construction.
All right, so how do we stop it?
Well, we've got an action step, which has to do with sending a letter to Secretary of Energy Chu and President Obama. And if you want to do it yourself, fine. But if you want to go to www.nirs.org, On the front page, there's a picture of the Secretary of Energy looking a little bit like a deer in the headlights. And under that is an opportunity to press a link and be guided to that action alert, which is what we do nationally, is help people who want to take action know where and when to do it most effectively.
Well, you're the first one on my show to link our national energy strategy with Bambi. So tell me, what's happening in VC Summer, the other one where they started construction?
That has also received a license. It's not at all clear what the status of federal money for it will be. And right now that reactor is fixing to possibly not only not happen, but potentially bring down this major merger between Duke Energy and Progress Energy that would actually make it the largest regulated utility in the United States if those two merge, both North Carolina-based corporations. But there's a big controversy about percentage ownership in the VC Summer project and some backroom deals going on, and it really remains to be seen when the fog clears the status of that project and also potentially the status of that merger.
So VC Summer does not have a nuclear loan guarantee from the feds yet.
It does not.
But they're not even pursuing one. They're claiming they can get private money.
Well, that would all have to do with construction work in progress and pre-billing their customers, and assumes that some commercial bank is going to get in, which has not, as far as I know, occurred. I believe the commercial sector actually understands that nuclear power is not a tremendously good way to make money in a capitalist way. It's only a good way to collect money in a socialist way.
National socialism. We like to distinguish between democratic socialism and national socialism. Eugene V. Debs was a democratic socialist, and the nuclear industry engages in national socialism by the old definition of the corporate control of the state.
But
we won't go into
profit,
that on this show.
It's not enterprise in the sense of making something really useful and beneficial that people want to buy. People would be much happier buying solar power in a large distributed array and offshore wind. We don't tend to support wind in these mountains, but there's plenty of areas of the country where huge wind developments are happening at a third the cost of nuclear, both in terms of development and in terms of price on the market.
Right.
So what's the deal? Why should we, as a society, be subsidizing, which is what this, I'm using the word socialism, what I'm trying to mean is you're taking money out of people's pockets without their choice,
right.
whether it's through utility action called construction work in progress, which we believe is delegated taxation without representation, or whether it be through the federal loan guarantees. Either way, these enormous mega nuclear projects cannot happen. They're not going to be supported by basic capitalism. So
right.
our answer to how to stop them is pull the plug, cut the cord. If they want to do it, they have
to do it
with their own shareholders' money, and it ain't going
to
happen.
And just to clarify, the construction work in progress, the situation is that the ratepayers in South Carolina and in Georgia, as well as in Florida, are being forced to pay for nuclear projects as they're being built, and there's no guarantee that if they'll ever be finished. God forbid they should be finished. And if they continue to proceed, the ratepayers will be forced to pay, even though they're not allowed to vote on it. Is that correct?
They're not allowed to vote, and quite frankly, there's intergenerational equity, because a 75, 80-year-old individual paying their electric bill probably will never receive any benefit at all. And other people may receive cancer, whereas they could have had a solar panel.
Now, how much have rates gone up in Georgia so far to pay for Vogtle?
You know what? I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you that historically, my former husband was living 20 miles from the first two Vogtles when they came online, and his electric bill tripled overnight the day that the rates for Vogtle hit.
Jeez,
his home.
Wow.
Tripled.
Bob, is this a national trend here? I know that Iowa, they tried to get Iowa and Missouri both turned down this construction work in progress idea. Bob Alvarez?
Yes. I think that because of the hard times people are undergoing, that they're more mindful of these things than before about how much they're going to have to pay for electricity and how big are their bills going to jump, as a result of this. And I think that that's having a major role in these battles over whether or not the consumer is going to shoulder the expense of nuclear power construction, you know, especially given its rather long and detailed history of enormous cost overruns.
Yes, and Mary, just for one last thing here,
yeah.
Before we get to radioactive tuna, which I'm sure everybody's dying to hear about, I understand that the summer plant. Duke Power, or is it Duke, or is who's building Summer?
It's been primarily South Carolina Gas and Electric,
okay.
But Duke has gotten in, and that's what's potentially threatening this merger.
Right, and so they need to get a rate hike in North Carolina to pay for the one in South Carolina. And my understanding is there's been ferocious resistance. I've posted a piece at nukefree.org from NC Warren,
yes.
A really good group with Jim Warren, and also one from Florida, as we mentioned, about rate hikes to pay for these things. But I understand there's a serious campaign in your home state against paying for the summer reactor in South Carolina. Is that correct?
It's not only the summer reactor. Duke wants to build two additional reactors at a previously canceled site that they've renamed Lee. So they're actually trying to put North Carolina ratepayers on the hook for four new reactors. And, yes, they want to say that the North Carolina ratepayers have to pay it because we're going to get some of the electricity. But there is a great campaign called Consumers Against Rate Hikes, and great groups like AARP and some of the justice organizations, in addition to NC Warren, are mobilizing and saying, you know, this is our front yard, this is our backyard, this is our side yard, and this isn't what we want.
You mean
so we don't want to pay for it.
The geezers are up in arms about the nukes here through the AARP? I've been a member of the AARP for 16
years. Well, why
should
you pay for something that isn't going to come online until well after you're 6 feet under, right?
That's right.
So I want to leave you with one thought. I do
Please.
Have to go, but you're going to talk about radiation. And
yes.
A lot of people do not know that when it comes to people who've been exposed to radiation, men get cancer, men die from that cancer, absolutely. But for every two men who die from radiation cancer-related cancer, three women.
Yeah.
Two men, three women. And in the little children comparison, it's even more stark. It's double for little girls between the ages of 0 and 5 compared to little boys. Now, we have a lot of controversy about radiation studies, and I myself question some of the work that's in this very book, but it comes from the National Academy of Sciences, and I think it's high time that we start talking about the fact that we need to protect men better while we protect women at all. So.
Well, thank you, Mary. And we do have a country of 310 million people with 150 million close to it. Certainly between 100 and 150 million people in this country have cancer now as we speak.
Yes.
It's the it's the biggest growth industry in America is cancer.
Yes, and we need to cut that off, too, along with the money.
All right,
so
well,
thanks, Harvey.
Thank you, Mary Olson from Nuclear Information Resource Service, NIRS.org, doing great work in North Carolina. And we've been talking about nuclear power reactors under construction. But I have one of the great experts in the country on radiation and health, Robert Alvarez, my esteemed co-author from a book we did called Killing Our Own, which was published in 1982. And, Bob, you were the font of wisdom on that book. And now you have put out a piece, which I published at nukefree.org. I linked it, about how the National Public Radio is there no end to these guys. Did a piece saying NPR, I guess it was Morning Edition or All Things Considered or whatever, about how we have found, our radiation has been found in the tuna being caught off of California, and the NPR says it's not dangerous.
Well,
is that true?
Well, I mean, I think you can't make a blanket statement of safety based on a sample of 15 fish. And while it may not be that dangerous to eat those fish, we don't really know. And I think that they avoided a much bigger, important question, which is to what extent that they found this in bluefin tuna caught off of Southern California with radiation levels about 10 times higher than you would expect.
Ugh.
Is this a signal that the world's food chain could be compromised? And
well, what do you think?
Well, this is what I think. If you go by the official estimates as to how much cesium-137, one of the radioactive materials that was released in a large amount from the Fukushima accident, in terms of official estimates, it's roughly equivalent to that which was released by an 11-megaton nuclear bomb, thermonuclear weapon,
Jesus,
in the South Pacific in the 1950s.
11 megatons is very substantially larger than
11 million tons of TNT.
But it's larger than the bombs that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Oh, many times more.
Yeah, right.
And after that one shot, it resulted in such widespread contamination. You know, it killed a Japanese fisherman, and others became severely ill, as you recall. And the Japanese government had to confiscate 4 million pounds of contaminated fish.
4 million pounds of contaminated fish. What did he do with the tuna that was radioactive last week?
Well, I'm not sure. The study itself is a very good study. I mean, it's a very interesting because it gives you some insights about how animals like bluefin tuna, which are kind of at the top of the food chain in the ocean and roam very, very large areas, you know, basically migrated from from Japan to the west coast of the United States. And over that period, the fish grew substantially in size, and it provided some interesting insights as to how rapidly the radioactive cesium is absorbed, how much is given off as it grows and moves away, and all these things.
But what does it do to people?
Well, the question is I just don't believe that you can make a blanket statement of safety based on such a small sample that you know, really what you had is a release of cesium-137 equivalent to an 11-megaton thermonuclear explosion, which blanketed the Pacific Ocean, about 600,000 square miles of the Pacific Ocean, the Northern Hemisphere in Europe, with radioactive cesium. And this stuff doesn't all fall out in a nice, neat way where the further you get away from the source, the more diluted it is. And having done a considerable amount of research into what happened in the 50s, in the Marshall Islands, when I was working in the Senate, we forced a great deal of information to be declassified. One of the things that they realized, at least a year after this huge test, is that the fallout does not deposit in a way where you can expect the highest concentrations to be near the source. Some of the highest concentrations can be from rainout from storms, where as much as 100% of the radioactivity would just fall out of the sky into the ocean. And they were basically pointing out that some fish are swimming through this and are getting much higher concentrations.
Now, what about Pacific salmon? I was a vegan. I am a vegan, and actually since Fukushima, I've stopped eating all fish. And my focus was on the only fish I was really eating in any quantity was salmon, which all pretty much came from Alaska and the North Pacific. Would you say that the salmon has been compromised?
I don't know. I mean, you know, we are basically operating with such little information. Quite frankly, the amount of information that's being reported about the radiological impacts of this accident are, in a way, less than what we were being told from the atmospheric bomb testing program.
And that's not accidental, is it? I mean, you know, we do have the resources to get this information.
Absolutely.
And so there really is no, it's not like, oh, goodness, there's no information. It's that the government and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, whoever else, the EPA has decided not to pursue getting us the information about this.
Well, you know, and I think that it's hard to say why this is going on, but, you know, it's really quite disconcerting to learn after the accident that the US EPA's radiological monitoring network, a big fraction of it, wasn't functioning.
Well,
and that, it had to do with just, you know, neglect.
Yeah, it sounds like the voting machines in Ohio.
And, right. And so, and the reporting on this, you know, is largely in terms of the kind of information you need to know, in terms of, well, how much got out, where did it go, what was the nature and extent of the accident and its degree, have been largely under the control of the Tokyo Electric Power Company. And I think the U.S. Department of Energy and the U.S. military was certainly deploying a lot of assets during the course of the accident in terms of, you know, aerial radiological surveillance and things like that. And I think there's a lot of information that has not really been shared with the public,
right,
about what the extent of the releases were. I mean, I find it remarkable that it took nearly 14 months of warning from people like myself, and then there was a growing chorus of others to point out that that they're nowhere near out of the woods in stabilizing those reactor ruins, and that the most dangerous situation really is still going on in terms of the spent fuel at reactor number 4.
Well, let's talk about it a minute. The most recent piece of yours that I've posted at nukefree.org is NPR's, quote, safe radioactive tuna. Mm-hmm. And I will just tell all my listeners that I have stopped eating all fish as a result of Fukushima. That's just not something I'm going to do anymore. Most of my fish was salmon. Most of it caught in the North Pacific. And that's right where the radiation went. And, I have not seen any systematic monitoring of fish. In fact, by the U.S. EPA or other agencies of this government, in fact, I believe that they specifically discontinued monitoring radiation in fish early into the accident, which began March 11, 2011, and, you know, in Fukushima. And now you've also discussed, and Bob, you are one really who's putting out, you and Arnie Gunderson have been putting out the major stuff on this, although Senator Ron Wyden went there. I presume you may have talked with him or guided him, but at Unit 4, can you describe what's going on at Fukushima Unit 4 and why everyone is so concerned?
Well, this reactor has about has the largest amount of spent fuel that's been irradiated, and it contains I estimated it contains about 10 times more cesium-137 that was released from Chernobyl. The pool is about 100 feet off the ground. It's exposed to the open sky. It doesn't have a containment dome over it like the reactor.
Is there any water in this pool?
There's water in the pool. And
it's 100 feet high.
But you know, the system of providing water, it has had to be jury-rigged because the whole cooling closed-loop infrastructure at the site was destroyed. So you've got all the spent fuel sitting in this pool in a building that experienced an explosion that essentially compromised the structural integrity of the building in a high-consequence earthquake zone where the geological experts, both in Japan and Europe and the United States, are noting that there's an increased frequency of earthquakes occurring in that region, and it most likely the next major earthquake of the size that occurred 14 or so months ago near the Fukushima nuclear site.
Well, wasn't even that close.
The epicenter will actually be closer to the nuclear site.
Right. So the 9.0 or so Richter scale earthquake that resulted in the tsunami that caused this multiple catastrophe at Fukushima was actually more than 100 miles away from the Fukushima site.
That's right. And so at least the prominent geologists of the U.S. Geological Survey, the European Geologic Union, Japanese geologists are all pretty much predicting that the next big one's going to happen even closer, and it may happen sooner than later.
So do we really, this is almost a bad acid trip here. The geniuses who designed these Fukushima reactors and so many others around the world decided to put the spent fuel pool, I mean, this is just hard to believe, 100 feet in the air.
Well, if you look back at the nuclear catastrophes the world has experienced, and, for example, the Chernobyl catastrophe of 1986, what that revealed was the folly of not having an extra barrier of thick concrete and steel surrounding the core. that is required for modern plants in the U.S., Japan, and elsewhere. And so all that, you know, that plant blew up. It had a raging fire that went on for days and days and released these enormous amounts of radioactivity that traveled, you know, over 1,000 and deposited severe levels of contamination over distances of 1,000+ miles.
Oh, man. I mean, but now what we
have... but I guess the point I'm trying to make about the Fukushima accident, this really revealed the folly of operating several nuclear power plants that don't have leak-tight containments in a high-consequence earthquake zone while storing huge amounts of highly radioactive spent fuel in vulnerable pools high above the ground.
It's insane. I mean, I was in Japan in the mid-70s, and I actually wrote an article that talked about Fukushima. And, you know, the idea, it boggles the mind that General Electric could design a reactor that has a fuel pool where you take the deadliest substances ever created by humankind, which are fuel rods that come out of nuclear plants after they've sustained a chain reaction for X number of years or months. And then they sit them not on the ground, not in secure locations, but 100 feet in the air. And so what we're now facing, and Bob, correct me if I'm wrong, we're talking with Robert Alvarez of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., one of the great experts on nuclear power and nuclear weapons as well. But we are seeing now at Fukushima Unit 4 a spent fuel pool with God knows how much, well, you may know how many tons of highly, insanely radioactive fuel rods with cooling barely hanging in there. And am I overstating the case to say that a major, even not that big an earthquake at the site could knock this pool to the ground and it would not have coolant? And these,
well, that's the big fear, is that this pool could topple. Or even if the pool doesn't topple, what might happen is that the water supply could be disrupted or the pool could leak and drain. And why this is such a big concern is that the spent fuel contains a tremendous amount of radioactivity that decays, and it gives off a lot of heat. And that's one of the reasons why they have them in pools, is both because they're extremely radioactive. I mean, if you were if a person were to be 1 foot away from a single freshly removed spent fuel assembly, they would get a lethal dose in a matter of seconds.
You just kill over dead. And that's, of course, one of the reasons why it's been so difficult to get Fukushima under control, is the radiation levels are so brutal.
But the other thing that happens is that if it is not cooled, and by the way, by the time the water drains down to that level where the fuel is exposed, the radiation coming off the spent fuel is so large that it's you're talking about life-threatening exposures to anybody that tries to get near it to deal with it.
Right. And so, short term, I mean, this isn't like the guys who can come in and are going to get cancer in a couple of years.
So then what happens is that the first thing that starts to happen, if there's steam and water and it's interacting with the metal cladding, it's made of an alloy of zirconium, which is very reactive.
Bob, we have 1 minute, unfortunately.
Okay, and basically the bottom line is that the cladding catches fire like a Roman candle. And then you have a catastrophic release of radioactivity. We reported in 2003, several colleagues and myself reported that a spent fuel pool fire in the United States would render an area uninhabitable as large as 60 times more than that created by the Chernobyl accident.
Well, that's the whole world, basically. We're talking with Bob Alvarez. We're almost done out of time, unfortunately. Bob, I'll ask you if you want to join us next week, if you can, to finish this up, because I'm afraid this is actually the number one story on Earth right now, is the spent fuel pool flying high in the air above Fukushima. Everybody who knows anything about it is living in absolute terror of the possibility of another earthquake at Fukushima. Bob Alvarez has been publishing about it along with Arne Gundersen, and not many other people have been paying attention to.
Well, finally, the New York Times caught on.
Finally, yes, and that's because of what you and Arnie have been doing, and Ron Wyden went there, the senator from Oregon. This is the most dangerous thing happening on Earth right now. We've been talking with Robert Alvarez of the Institute for Policy Studies. Bob, what's your website again?
www.ips.dc.org.
Bob is a leading, if not the leading, expert on the health dangers of radiation and nuclear power. My esteemed co-author on the book Killing Our Own, The Disaster of America's Experience with Atomic Radiation. This has been another Green Power Wellness Show. Thrilling, laugh-filled hour about nuclear power. And we will be back next week with more, and hopefully the spent fuel pool at Fukushima 4 will still be in the air. Talk to you then.
Yeah.